Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by AdStream. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me as usual at the studios of CBS Interactive, Scott Rohde of PR agency House Party.
Hi, Tim.
And friend of the podcast, Jonathan S. from the Media Alliance.
Hi, Tim.
This week, the secrets of good journalism, interview nightmares, the age falls foul of the press council, the election's effect on advertising and media, a clear run for Pack to the Rafters, and new ads, snogging Sophie Monk and losing your hand to Carlton Draft. Now, next week sees a gathering of the Journo tribes under the neutral banner of the Walkley Foundation. Among those speaking will be columnist Mark Dapin. Let's hear from him.
Now, one of the things you're going to be speaking at various events, including the Walkley's one, is interview technique, how to do a good interview. What are the kind of key things that you've picked up?
Well, I'm actually going to talk about how to do a bad interview, because that's kind of what I specialise in. I'm going to talk about the mistakes that I have made, which include, famously, in my small world at least,
Gordon Ramsay.
Gordon Ramsay, yeah, getting kicked out of his house after just under 16 and a half minutes of conversation that had cost the magazine about $4,500 to get.
Do you think it works for your style, though? Because you make the readers a part of the story, don't you? You tell them what went wrong, and that's actually some of the entertainment of reading the piece.
Yeah, I mean, it's not intentional, though. And immediately after that, I was not thinking, oh, great, I got kicked out of Gordon Ramsay's house. I was thinking, this is a disaster. Am I ever going to tell my boss? How are we going to justify these expenses? And what can I possibly write? As usual, I settle for writing about my own personal experience. So, yeah, in a way, when things go wrong, it's not as catastrophic for me as it might be for other people. I wouldn't recommend that people approach things as shambolically and ill-informed as I often do.
And with the Gordon Ramsay one, where did it go wrong?
He issues journalists with a list of six things that he won't talk about. Sometimes it's seven things, often those things change. But what remains a constant on that list is he won't talk about his relationship with his father, which I thought was by far the most interesting thing to talk about, so I asked him question after question about it. He ducked them, dodged them, said, I don't want to talk about it. I just ignored that and continued thinking that probably he really did want to talk about it because he'd written a book about it.
So that was a horror story of Mark Dapin's adventures with Gordon Ramsay when things go wrong. Jonathan, the conference is a sort of joint venture with Walkley Foundation and Media Alliance, and Mark Dapin is one of the speakers. Firstly, you're a journalist by background. What was your worst ever interview experience?
Oh God, I suppose that you know stories like that are legion. I can remember one of my first. I'd not long been in Australia, and I'd not long been working for the Australian. And my chief of staff sent me off to interview Wayne Goss, who was at that stage the Premier of Queensland. Really didn't give me a brief, and I had about sort of 10 minutes to prepare, and I had that awful thing where you go completely blank. And I knew, you know, at that stage I hadn't really got to speed with Queensland politics, and Wayne was very, very nice. Understood it, urged me on with his eyebrows, but I kept having to sort of corpse and say, just let me think of something. And happily, the photographer helped me out. And I think every journalist can probably tell a story where, you know, the photographer he or she's working with actually jumps in and starts sort of prompting and asking questions.
Do you know, right back to local papers, like doing the 50th Golden Wedding anniversaries, which you always go along to as the Cub reporter. Of course, the photographer's been to a million of those before. And at that point where you're missing something really obvious, they'll just say if they're a nice photographer, they'll just say very gently, just like it's conversation with them, so where did you meet then? Or, you know, that really obvious one that you should have asked as a journalist.
Yeah, I think every journalist's got a story where you know, the photographer's helped them out of a hole, and I certainly sort of depended on working well with the snappers that I kind of worked with.
Yeah, Scott, your worst interview experience?
Oh, I'm just trying to rack my brain about that one. I know that I had one experience that I don't want to talk about here. That was I went to interview a footballer. I won't say who it was, but he played for a large football team in Glasgow, and he'd just called a player on another team a black bastard, basically. And he denied it. So when the team arrived, I had to come and ask him again if he did it. And he, because he'd said already, he only swears in Italian. That may give you even more of an idea who it is. And I'll never forget, like, and I was nervous about asking the question because, you know, the entire football team's there, they're all staring at you. And I asked the question, and he just looked at me as if I was the scummiest person on the planet, and like, just looked at me and went, pff. And I lost my temper, and I had to get one of the journalists to hold me back because I lost it. And I was, there's a good footage of me getting pulled back by one of the other journalists at the time. And that's kind of, you know, because the thing of doing interviews is you can, you know, you have to try and compose yourself, but there's times when you lose it. I did have one story that you might find interesting. I had to interview a woman who, her and her husband had been caught having sex in a plane, and I had to go speak to them and, you know, get the story, because BA banned them for life, basically.
Well, at least it was the husband and wife, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So I went to the house, and
they should be celebrating family values.
Well, I got to the house and I interviewed them for 10 minutes, and the husband goes, "I've got to go to work." He goes off to work, and the woman goes, "Do you need some pictures for the paper?" And I went, "Yeah, that'd be great." And she gives me a stack of pictures, and I'm sifting through them. And as I sift through, they start getting a bit dodgier and dodgier, and then I'm like, and then she's like, "I've got more upstairs if you want to go upstairs and see them." And I was like, out the door.
Is this when you were with the son?
Yeah.
So, you know, first she obviously came with expectations.
Yeah.
Excellent. Preparation. You mentioned preparation with your interview. That was exactly the same for me. I once, at very short notice, had to interview Danny Minogue on the telephone. This is sort of back when I was on a local paper, and literally I had 2 minutes, and I was working in Brighton in the UK at the time. She was going to be singing there or something. So there was literally just time for, you know, her PRs to fax through her potted bio, which kind of mentioned that she was married to Julian McMahon, and so son of former Prime Minister of Australia. So I sort of piped up, knowing nothing about Australian politics, never having been there in my life. First question to her was, "What's it like to have a father-in-law who's a politician?" Well, he's dead, actually.
Oh.
Yes. And that actually was the high point of the interview.
Jeez. Preparation is key. Those days, when you don't prepare for that interview, it's always going to blow up in your face.
Well, it just got worse and worse. But then, because, like, obviously I'd sort of put her hackles up, you know, I then sort of, you know, I was sort of looking down. I had her tour schedule, which is pretty minor. She wasn't going terribly well in her career at the time. It was things like, you know, Wolverhampton Civic Hall and that sort of thing. So, but I kind of sort of said, oh, you know, what you doing talking to the likes of us in Brighton then, or performing for the likes of us in Brighton? Really thinking that I was giving a soft question where she would say, you know, want to play intimate venues, link up with my fans, which is like, well, if that's your attitude, we can end it right here. But it made for quite a funny interview to write up, which which in Mark Dappin's case, the Gordon Ramsay thing obviously was exactly the same.
Well, that became his story, didn't it?
Yes. Yeah. You know, whether the disaster is the, you know, becomes the story. So that's obviously just one of the elements, the sort of the art of the interview that we'll be talking about. It's probably worth just getting a bit of a sense of the conference, which it's actually quite long for a conference. It's 3 days, isn't it?
Look, yeah, because we're trying to bring in a lot of elements together, and, you know, looking at the programme, I think successfully, we're trying to address, first of all, the whole idea is to sort of, is to discuss really the changing nature of journalism and communications. Essentially, we want to bring together, you know, the core of journalism is storytelling. We're trying to bring together storytellers to talk about the way what they do is changing, the way new technology, new techniques are changing what they do. So we're also incorporating script writers, long-form documentary makers. We have a separate stream for PR people talking about how they're sustaining narrative and new techniques for what they do. We have a special day for freelancers. The other key thing to this, which I feel completely torn, actually, we're combining the conference sessions with an almost continuous stream of training sessions where really sort of top operators are explaining what they do and how they do it and doing masterclasses. And, you know, I look down the down the program, and I see at the same time we've got a panel with Jay Rosen talking about writing in the internet age, against Peter Gawler from Underbelly explaining how you go about writing a script. Now I know I'd like to be in two places at once, and I think people, when they look at the programme, will find that there is so much on offer.
Well, there is some of that. I notice I'm speaking on a couple of the more, I suspect, minor panels on the Thursday. There is a 5-minute crossover where I'm speaking at two panels which is going to be interesting, I think.
Yes. Well, you know, I think there is some. There's a lot that the different branches of communications can learn from each other, and there's a lot that that people involved in say making documentaries or in script writing have in common, which is telling stories. And the whole idea of this being a narrative conference is that we are looking at the way that we can sustain quality in storytelling. We can increase, you know, our audience penetration. We can continue to tell stories as well as we always have.
Well, one of the things I like about it as well is the fact that it's not yet another look at, oh, whoa, what's going to happen to journalism? Yeah. What's the business model, etc.? It's actually a bit more about, as you say, the craft of storytelling rather than that same old debate again.
Yeah, and I think trying to kick it on a bit forward as well. I mean, really, from the get-go, Tuesday morning, we've got at 7:30, there's a breakfast session.
So that's next Tuesday, the 10th? Is it the 10th?
Yes. At the Teachers Federation, starting at 7:30 a.m.
In Sydney.
There's a breakfast session. And we have Alan Noble, who's the head of innovation at Google, and he's going to talk about the importance of innovation to journalism. And really, you know, one of the key messages we find is that it's the organisations which are embracing innovation that are beginning to sort of cut through and make progress. At this point, obviously, it would be good to talk about the... one of the things we're going to do at the conference is launch our second Future Journalism Report.
So this is an investigation of where it's going and what the public think, as much as anything.
Well, yes. I mean, the 2 years ago we did the first report, which was very much a bit of a story of doom and worry. It was very much, look, you know, this, everything's changing. There's a tidal wave about to hit the industry. You know, brace yourselves. 2 years on. Things are looking a lot more positive. The numbers we're seeing from the advertising world, the revenue flowing into journalism, is, you know, the carnage we thought we were going to see is abating, I think. We're very hopeful that news organisations are going to start to kind of be able to move forward and to start to really exploit the new technology that's going to enable them to sort of do the jobs better. We've talked to journalists, we've talked to members of the public, talked to journalists about the way they do their jobs, and members of the public about what they want from journalism. There are some very, very interesting findings, which I'm not going to preface now because
maybe some of the questions. What questions are you asking them that are triggering the interesting findings?
Well, with the members of the public, we've asked people how they get their journalism, what they think of, you know, how they trust journalists. The sorts of whether they pay for journalism is the $64,000 question, I guess. We asked people, interestingly, whether it mattered to them who the journalist was, who was giving them the report or had written the story, and that's a very interesting. I think you'll be very interested to see the findings there.
That's the one that I can't wait to see because, yeah. Of course, every journalist believes their byline has a value.
Absolutely, yeah, and so we're keeping our powder dry on that, but really watch this space because I think that we'll have a lot of fun.
And when will you be releasing that on the Tuesday
morning.
On the Tuesday morning, yeah, excellent. Who are the main kind of keynotes?
We've got John Nichols, who's a senior writer for The Nation magazine in the States. Now, he's just written a book called The Death and Life of American Journalism, which, as you know, America has been buffeted far more by the digital revolution than we have here. And his sort of main thesis is that what's really important, what do we want to say, you know, about journalism? Journalism performs an important democratic function. If you sort of kick aside all the worrying about business models, his thesis is what we need to end up with is an industry and a craft that serves the public to preserve, you know, to preserve its democratic function. And he's come up with a lot of things which I think will stimulate debate in Australia because, for example, one of his big things, he talks about government subsidising journalism. And he points out that in America, government has always subsidised journalism. Actually, quite significantly, through various things, through postal subsidies. That's why you got the huge plurality of newspapers that you have in the States. Unfortunately, a lot of them are falling over, and he's basically saying, "How can we work out a way to preserve that plurality of voices?"
I suppose, arguably, that has always been the case in most parts of the world. That in that you know, a big source of advertising are local councils, well, for instance. You know, so to a certain extent, I guess the public purse has always supported newspapers wherever you are in the world.
And yet there's this sort of perception I've seen, it's been written about a lot over here, you know, that every time anyone raises the question of government subsidising journalism, there's a sort of huge amount of hollow laughter coming from a lot of the commercial news organisations saying we couldn't possibly have that, you know, we've got to be completely independent. And yet, actually, if you look at the list of... There's a very good report from the OECD, which canvasses this, and it looks at a list of countries and the kinds of discussions they're having about how government can help preserve journalism. And, you know, really, these are the sort of discussions we need to be having here, because while obviously, you know, as a union which represents journalists working in commercial news organisations, you know, we're all about the continuing health of the commercial news industry. We're very mindful of the fact that journalism is a very, very important part of democracy and it exists to serve its public. And so we want to work out ways in which we can continue to do that.
Let's talk about one or two of the other speakers. They're almost representation from every single news organisation. Seems to have somebody speaking. Which are the other ones that you're particularly looking forward to hearing?
Well, before I get onto the Australian ones, the other person who I'm a big fan of is Jay Rosen.
No, he's doing it by video, is he?
No, he's coming.
He's
coming here.
I didn't
realise. Jay Rosen is in the house.
Yeah, okay. And when is he? What's?
Well, he arrives on Wednesday morning. Right, comes straight to the conference, and you know, jet lag and all, is going to talk about some.
So the flight's not delayed then.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we're really kind of keeping our fingers crossed. He has written recently about one of the, you know, what he considers to be one of the drawbacks of digital news, and that is the fact that its immediacy and its sort of quick snap nature means that sometimes you lose context. And he's trying to work out through experimentation how we can continue to supply context to journalism so that it does retain its sort of narrative quality. So he's going to talk a lot about that.
I'm really struggling because I want to come to the whole thing. At the same time, I somehow have to produce Mumbrella every day, you know?
Well, you could do it from the site, I reckon. That's the way to go.
Yeah, it may come to that, or it might just be very thin pickings next week for people to read. But yeah.
It is. I mean, I've got to say that it's a sensational lineup of different panels and speakers. And we've got people Monday, which is our kind of pre-conference.
And that's sort of teaching and seminary.
We've got seminars sort of all day, and then we kick off at 4:30 with a panel talking about 24-hour news, which is going to be moderated by Quentin Dempster, who's the chair of the Walkley Advisory Committee, and it's got Gavin Morris from the ABC, who's going to talk about the ABC continuous 24-hour news, which obviously we've all got an opinion on. Heather Allen from Al Jazeera and Angelos Frangopoulos from
Sky News.
From Sky. So. You know, expect the battle of the 24-hour news services. And then Peter Frey, editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, is going to talk about, you know, the changing nature of storytelling.
Now, I can't remember. It was a really good title for his session. I can't remember what it was.
Who Moved My Pyramid?
That was it, yes.
Which I think says it all, really, because obviously we all trained on how to use the old inverted pyramid.
Yes, for journalists, it was always the news pyramid, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, does that ever...
Do you want to just describe... It's a long time since I'd had to teach anyone the news pyramid.
Well, I guess the idea was in the days of hot metal and the old, you know, writing for the Stone, was that you got everything, you know, you aimed to get everything that was important up the top of the story, so that if someone came along with a razor blade and slashed the bromide off at the second par, people still knew what the story was about. So the inverted pyramid was that it was a big fat top and then tailed off towards the bottom, so it could be trimmed.
So you can sort of cut from the bottom.
Yeah, you know, and digital journalism renders that, frankly, you know, fairly obsolete. Although I guess there are people who would debate that. But,
well, I think the speed at which a story needs to go up means the bit will change how much you're going to write for it.
Exactly, and you know, these days you know what you've got to write, how long you've got to write it in, and you can change it as the story changes.
And just briefly, any other highlights in terms of the other speakers?
Well, look, I'm looking forward to hearing from all of the news organisations about what their plans are and how they intend to put them into effect. I think, you know, I think we all kind of appreciate that a couple of years ago when we did this last time, people were bracing, they were all kind of hanging on by their fingernails a little bit. And I think now... You know, the feeling is that that we're in a position where we can start to really look forward and kind of capitalise and make plans for the future. And I really want to hear what those are. And And hopefully I want to hear about how they're all going to hire lots more journalists and they're going to really kind of provide a much richer news experience.
And so, just finally on this topic, are there still places available for the conference?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. How do people find how to get along?
Well, if you go to www.walkleys.com, there's a link straight through to booking. So that's what I would advise people to do. It's a fantastic program. It's a very, very reasonable price. If you're a member of the Alliance, which, you know, we're hoping most people in journalism should be, then it's, you know, heavily subsidized for you. If you're a non-member, well, you should look at joining, but certainly come along and hear the goodies on offer.
Next up, we talk election. Now a commercial message. This week's podcast is brought to you by AdStream. These are the guys who make sure your ads get to stations, magazines and papers. Pretty much anywhere, actually. They've got an awesome new delivery system coming out soon. If you want to check it out, go to their website, www.adstream.com.au. So the lead-up to the election has seen a slew of good and not-so-good ads. We've got billboards, we've got virals, we've got TV ads. Any standouts for you, Scott? Any election messages broken through?
None whatsoever. I think, you know, the whole election's been just a bit of a non-starter, really. I'm sick of the media, you know, pointing fingers at the politicians and giving them this whole, you know, you're not doing enough, and yet never writing about what the actual policies are and never giving us what we actually want to hear about. They just keep doing this whole two horse race thing, you know, it's Abbott Gillard, you know, and that's we don't, you know, do you know what? There's a lot more than that, there's politicians out there.
Certainly though, in terms of the election messaging, you know, I get the impression there's not been a big dominant theme.
No, there isn't. It's just
that
this,
has changed the, no, the course
just,
of the story.
Just this wishwash of attacks, you know, and if your whole strategy is we're not as shit as those guys are, then, you know, that's a really poor strategy, and it seems to be what both of them are doing.
And John,
more liberal, actually.
From the media reporting of the election, do you see anyone who's covered themselves in glory so far?
Look, I've been following it on the Twitter sphere, and there's you know, the likes of Latika Burke and Annabel Crabb who are doing giving us a pretty much constant sort of stream of relevant and not so relevant information from the campaign buses.
And Latika has been teaching the pollies to tweet as well. You know, one or two of the older members.
There was the John Faulkner, wasn't
yes,
there?
Yes, that's
being
right.
Dragged kicking and screaming into the Twitter sphere, which I thought was quite amusing. I particularly loved the online poll in the Telegraph yesterday, which I think asked us to rate the various qualities of Abbott and Gillard. And for Abbott, you could say how you thought he was clever and thoughtful and strong and compassionate kind of thing. And for Gillard, you could say how you thought she was sneaky and underhand and untrustworthy, which I thought was a particularly fantastic little example of the modern online poll.
Fantastically poor? Fantastic.
Well, slightly satirical, isn't it?
Yes, I think so.
The telly has taken quite a satirical approach, really, with this Peter Best, the imaginary candidate.
Yeah, I'm still not quite sure I've got my head around this. I'm a friend of his on Facebook, and I don't know why I accepted his friendship, except that he seemed to have a lot of friends of mine in common. So, yes.
I think he's mainly, obviously, the creation of Joe Hildebrand, isn't he?
And today's question is, should he get married? Which obviously, and that,
because the idea is, he's for people who haven't come across it, he's an imaginary politician. Well, he's a real person who seems to dance to Telegraph's tune and standing as a candidate, and on any day he'll do whatever the polls tell him to do. So if it says get married, then he'll get married.
Well, I guess the interesting thing is that does highlight this very strange aspect of the campaign where Tony Abbott seems very, very keen for us to know that he's married with three children,
yeah,
and he faces the same bills as all the rest of us. And of course, the implications.
He doesn't know, does he? He's on a much bigger wage than most people. You know, I don't think he's probably got stocks and shares. He's probably doing all right. I figure he's not struggling as much as your average Joe.
It's a bit of a variation on the theme of, does he know how much a loaf of bread costs?
Yeah,
which I think has he been asked that yet?
I don't think so.
I think it must be a politician survival guide. You get beaten into you to remember how much a bottle of milk costs,
and every time you see a baby, you must leap and kiss it in the forehead.
And there was that story recently about which I thought was again quite strange. Has Julia Gillard only been kissing white babies? Do you remember that one?
I didn't even see that.
That was an interesting one. Yeah.
Dear. Next, we talk TV ratings. So intriguing week in the TV ratings. As much as anything, I guess one of the things that we found out was how ABC News 24 did in its first outing. So the first ratings came through from Sunday, although it's been on air for a couple of weeks. So Sunday nights, free-to-air household share of 0.7%. Scott, good result, bad result?
I'd say bad result. I'd say they really should have been looking for a little bit higher than that, let's be honest. I've not really seen a lot of promotion for it. I don't really think that they, you know, because you look at the promotion that Sky News gets compared to News 24, I just don't think they're pushing it hard enough. I don't mind it. I've watched on occasion now.
Jonty, good result, bad result?
Look, obviously, I'd like to see. I think it's the ABC's News 24 was a great idea. It's the obvious thing that a national broadcaster should be doing. Obviously, I'd like to see it successful. 0.7% intuitively doesn't sound like it's a huge amount. Hopefully, it's a slow burner. You know, we'll see if people cotton to it.
One point I would make is that immediately puts them ahead of Sky News. It's already reaching more people than Sky News because it's free to air.
Yeah, that's the key thing. It's a resources issue. I'd like to say they've got the resources to do a really fantastic job. I know that a lot of people at the ABC are very mindful of the fact that there seemed to be no new funding for this, and they were doing it from the larder that already exists. And I think they seem to be doing a really good job.
One thing I'd like to see is they stop doing the cutaways to, especially the British News is very good, like the Sky, where they cut away to a scene of something that's happening and nothing's actually happening. They talk about it for 5 minutes, then it cuts back. If you're going to be News 24... If there's nothing happening at that scene, go speak about some other news that's happening, because there's news happening everywhere.
And News 24 have been, they've almost been the opposite. They've been sticking with the programming and not always getting to the live bit.
Yeah.
So that's been the early criticism, isn't it?
That's good,
it?
Though.
But early days on that one. A couple of things just on the ratings, just to note. Packed to the Rafters, up above 2 million. Mm-hmm. So very dominant for them. Minute to Win It, Seven's game show, also doing pretty well. More than 1.4 million for a... pretty simple game show.
Did they come up with the format first, or did they come up with a name in that one?
Well, the format comes over from the US, and to me that's interesting in itself, because the guy who won $500,000 this week said in the interview with the Herald Sun afterwards, he went online and watched episodes from the US so he knew what challenges he'd been given, and then he practiced them for days and days and days so that when he got to the final challenge, he knew that he'd tried this something like 30 times and only succeeded 3 times so that he wouldn't do it. So it's an interesting thing about formats, that the same thing used to happen with Big Brother. The contestants would have a look at what had happened in other countries, so nothing would be a surprise.
But what I know is, did they come up with that name first and then create the game show around it, or did they create the game show and then the name around it?
It's high concept, isn't it? It's like snakes on a plane, you know. First came the name, then came the movie, which was slightly more disappointing. Now, next, we return to journalism. At some stage in every journo's career, there will be some sort of conflict of interest. The question is, how do you address it when it comes along? Not like The Age and its journalist Carolyn Webb did. Well, that's the ruling from the Australian Press Council anyway. Jonty, you're probably in a slightly awkward position because I guess you have to, be a neutral party in these things when different members of the Press Council are involved. But you can probably at least tell us what the job of the Press Council is and when it makes this sort of ruling.
Well, the Press Council, the Press Council's got a very, very important role because it really defends the craft. Excuse me. Press Council is there to defend the craft, really. The pressures to curtail the freedom of speech, the freedom of the press, are at times intense. And essentially, it's a self-regulatory body set up by the news industry. And it's there to sort of prove that we can do our jobs responsibly. And by and large, we do. Overwhelmingly, I've got to say, Australian news media behaves very responsibly. The Press Council therefore acts as sort of the adjudicator, and its rulings are taken pretty seriously on the whole.
So in this particular case, what happens when there is a complaint is if they uphold it, the newspapers have to publish the result. So the idea being they've got to tell their readers when they got it wrong, whether they agree with the finding or not.
Yeah, that's right. And they don't have to publish the whole finding; they have to publish something which gives the sense of the. Of what the finding was, and it is a form of redress, which is very important, because we have to be seen to be taking these judgments on board. And, you know, I can't stress enough that the Press Council, provides a really central role in sort of keeping us honest and showing the public that we are doing our jobs honestly and with integrity.
So this ruling against The Age, which was released late last week and has been much talked about this week, including on Media Watch, effectively The Age published quite a long story which is to do with rape allegations, later dismissed legally, against the then Victorian Minister Theophanous, who stood down while all this was going on. It later emerged that the journalist Carolyn Webb had a personal friendship with the alleged victim, which wasn't disclosed to readers. So probably the key comment from the Press Council was, in the course of the lengthy preparation of the article for publication, this relationship became known to the newspaper itself, and it appears so did the woman's previous inconsistent version of events. The article was concerned with very grave matters and focused heavily on highly personal allegations. In these circumstances, the newspaper should have assigned overall responsibility for the story to another journalist instead of, or at least in addition to, Ms. Webb. Alternatively, the relationship should have been disclosed in the article. And on those grounds, the complaint was... Scott, you know, the fact of the matter is, good journalists know lots of people.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's actually hard to tell where someone stops being a contact and starts becoming a friend.
Yeah, I agree with that. But in this case, you know, for something so serious, I think that they really should have stepped off from it and said to their news editor or chief of staff, said, look, you know, I am friends with this person. I think if you, because I think they stayed at her, she stayed at her house, didn't she?
That's right. It said that she'd been to her home in Greece.
I think when that happens, you're into the friendship round of contact territory, and I think that she really should have stepped back, passed it on to someone else.
It's difficult because how do you declare an interest?
Let me see. I'll try and put it this way. If I was still working at the Sun when my uncle was murdered. He was killed by three teenagers in Glasgow, and if that had happened, I would have had to walk away from that story, you know, because I have a personal involvement in it, and the story I would write would surely be biased because the way you feel towards what happened.
I guess it's more the grey area ones, isn't it?
But I don't think that's a grey area. You're talking about a rape case against a politician.
Yeah,
that's a huge story.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I sort of think, you know, I used to edit a magazine called Hospital Doctor, and at one stage I stayed in the house of someone who went on to become the chairman of the British Medical Association. Now, it was a visit I always viewed to myself, went up with a couple of other journos from the paper and we sort of, you know, made a weekend of it. But I always saw that as a work thing, you know, he wasn't my mate, I didn't see him afterwards.
Did you fly to another country?
But I went all the way from London to Liverpool, which is, you know, felt like another country. but you know, the point being, every time we wrote about them, we didn't have a little note at the end saying, you know, Tim once swam in the private swimming pool of... you know, the chairman of the BMA.
Well, I think this is a great area, but I think that on situations like that, if you want to kind of preserve, you know, your authenticity, then you should step away.
Jonty, what is there anything in the kind of codes of conduct on what the correct behaviour is, or is it more of a judgment call in individual cases?
Yeah, look, it's reasonably clear, actually, the Alliance Code of Ethics states that you should disclose any kind of personal interest that you have. And it's hard to see how you get around that if you're personal friends, then really.
Well, let's say for example, I count Scott as a friend. We put up a story about digital citizens next meeting, in which Scott's on the committee. Should I, every time I do the on Tuesday night's digital citizens, say at the end the writer of this piece is friends with the guys from Digital Citizens, for instance? You know, where sensibly?
Yeah,
is
I think that, as Scott said, it is a very grey area, but it's hard to see in this case. Where you wouldn't disclose the fact that you had a relationship with the person who's making the allegations.
The event is an event, whereas a story like that is an allegation. And it's an allegation. Interestingly enough, in the UK now, they've just changed the law that, you know, people who have been charged with rape have to remain anonymous now, which, you know, be something interesting to see over here because, you know, the rape victims have anonymity, so why not, you know, the person who's been charged as well.
Well, finally today, we'll be moving on to the slightly lighter side of media and marketing with some new ads. So Sophie Monk is the new face of Pepsi Max.
What if the the world was coming to an end, wouldn't you want to max the time you had? That's where Pepsi Max comes in. Buy any Pepsi Max, go online and tell us your ultimate max experience. Every week, someone wins 10 grand towards making it happen. Life's short, max it.
Some marvellous acting there. It's even better when you see the images to go with it. But yes, the world's ending. You've got minutes to live. What do you do? You have a nice diet drink to keep the weight off, obviously.
Yes.
And then you have a kind of awkward half kiss on the lips with Sophie Monk, with a fireman or whatever it was. Good ad?
No. I know that some of the listeners will complain that I'm always whinging about adverts out there, but it's not a good ad, is it? It's similar to other ads. It's kind of, it doesn't really, would you drink a Diet Pepsi if you've got 10 minutes for the world to end? No, would you? Hell, you'd be either drinking a bottle of whiskey, or you'd be having sex, or you'd be, I don't know.
Chopty, thumbs up or thumbs down for the ad?
Look, I think it's a bit old hat, isn't it? I mean, I don't know if you remember the video that Midyear did for Vienna.
Vienna, yeah.
Which canvassed the same thing, and obviously he went and made love with his.
I remember the video. I had no idea that was
number one
for
some weeks.
Yeah, it was.
He didn't race out and buy a fizzy drink.
So that was all about the last hours on the earth, was it? It was all black. It was black and white and quite dramatic.
Cocktail party. They were all kind of. Yeah, that was the end.
Wow, I'm going to have to
great song.
Go to YouTube and watch that again. Now, moving on, there's another ad, this one for beer.
Sensing his unhinged ex-girlfriend's presence in the bar, Nick goes with his natural instinct and perfectly mimics the behaviour of the speckled shell tortoise.
Stay down there, just stay down there, mate.
You're right.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Carlton Natural. Go with your natural instinct.
Won't play the whole of that clip because mostly it's visual gags. So the idea being that men could mimic natural animals, so, you know, make his head bury into his jumper. Natural animals, yes. It's a legitimate term. Or possibly not. But they can do things like bury their head in their jumper when the ex-girlfriend comes past, or shed his hand so that the hand carries on holding the girlfriend while she talks about
it. That'd be the hand that has the beer in it.
Well, that is one of the hitches which one of our commenters did talk about. But, you know, well, he can then go off and talk to his mate. So it's about using your natural defences to spend man time. And jaunty, like that ad?
Well, this is an old theme that beer ads have, since the beginning of time, I think, have exploited this idea of bloke's a bit of a lad, quite clever too. This is how he reacts to a pressure situation, and you know, I think that's a well-travelled path, and they travel it. I agree with Scott on the second ad where he leaves his hand in the beer at the bar. I can't see the point in that, you know. But
that's bad branding, really. It's like saying I'm willing to run away from my beer.
Yeah, beer's expendable.
Yeah, exactly.
Which we know it never is.
I think a real clever man would not get himself in that situation in the first place.
That is all the time we have for today. Thank you very much to my co-host Scott Rohde. And to friend of the podcast, Jaunty Est. Thanks also to CBS for use of their studios. Production was by Georgina Pearson. That was the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle pip.